أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we're starting a new series. This is our eighth series. We'll be talking about the economic system of Islam. Today is our introductory program to this new series. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Could I ask you perhaps to explain how this new series that we're about to embark upon, how it relates to the previous series of this program, and what is the relevance of the subject, in your opinion?
Okay. First of all, with respect to the tie between this series and the previous ones, you might notice that in the first three series, the emphasis was more on the articles of faith, the matters of belief. In the fourth series, the emphasis shifted to pure acts of worship, you know, the other pillars of Islam. In the fifth series, it dealt with the moral teaching of Islam and all related topics. In the seventh series, which is just finished, we started dealing with some aspects of the application of Islam in the day-to-day life. In the seventh series, the focus was on the social system mm-hmm. of Islam, quite an extended series. And so we're simply moving on to other aspects of application of Islam in the day-to-day life, one of which, of course, is economics. And in the future, we hope also to be able to touch on other aspects like political system in Islam or system of government and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'm sure some of our viewers must be saying to themselves that we've never heard of an economic system for Christianity or Buddhism. That many of them may wonder, how does the topic of economics relate to religion?
Well, to start with, if you look at it in a more general or broad way, what is religion, basically? Religion is, you know, a set of beliefs or tenets which organize or regulate the relationship between the individual and his creator, God, capital G, and between the person and other people, other human beings, between the person and the universe, and even the relationship of the person to himself or herself. In that sense, then, in a way, you could say that religion organizes or regulates human behavior. And surely, one aspect of human behavior is economic behavior. Because, as economists put it, in economics, really, you're talking about human behavior in the area of production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services. Now, when we talk about human behavior, whether in economic area or other areas, this behavior is not value-free, nor is it value-neutral. In other words, the question of values and principle is part of that behavior. It is connected with the ideological foundation of that faith. In fact, in Islamic perspective, the economic part of human behavior as part of religion, quote unquote, has been mentioned in the Quran as part of the mission of all prophets and messengers in the past. For example, in the Quran, in chapter 21, verse 73, speaking about so many prophets in the past, like Abraham and other Israelite prophets, it still mentions something that relates to economics, the question of charity or social justice, yes, and the economic distribution of wealth, for example. And that speaks about several prophets. In chapter 7 in the Quran, particularly in verse 85, it speaks about Prophet Shu'aib, and again, how he was teaching his people not to deal in fraud and to be just and fair and equitable in their financial dealings. In chapter 83 in the Quran also, it condemns people who deal in fraud and do not give people their due right as part of the commercial activity. However, despite of the fact that this is a basic principle, a broad characteristic of the teaching of all prophets, we find, though, that the followers of those religions have interpreted these economic teachings in a variety of ways, sometimes going into one extreme or the other. I think most people are familiar with certain interpretation that views the economic goods or enjoyment of life as something that should not be really focused on, and that a person who would like to achieve felicity and righteousness would do best by avoiding or keeping away from worldly affairs, and that richness or wealth in itself makes it difficult for the person to enter into paradise in itself. Now, in the case of Islam, we find that its economic system is not just a matter of broad appeal to charity, voluntary charity, which is not enforceable, but we find that Islam gives a more comprehensive approach or view of economic life, which in turn is ideologically founded. It is based on the basic teaching and tenets of Islam.
Now, you use the phrase economic system of Islam. When you use that phrase, is that the same as economics viewed from an Islamic perspective?
Well, not necessarily, even though it might sound too close. You see, when we talk about economics as such, we're really talking about a science or field of study which focus on the study of economic phenomena and try to derive some principles or laws which regulate this economy. Most people must have heard of the laws of supply and demand, for example.
Yes.
You know, supply and demand is a matter that applies or cuts across varieties of economic systems, varieties of ideologies, because it's a basic law in economic life. The same thing when you talk, for example, about efficiency and production. Whether you're talking about Eastern or Western economy, you're talking about still a basic concept of trying to be efficient, use the minimum resources and get the maximum output out of your production process. However, when we speak of economic system, then there could be so many systems. You see, economic laws are universal, or some of them are universal. But economic systems could vary. You could have a communist economic system, a socialist economic system, a capitalist economic system, an Islamic economic system. See, because when you talk about a system, you're talking about a system which is based on certain goals, principles, philosophy, which are quite unique to that particular ideology. Now, this economic system could also be extended further beyond the discussion of philosophical principles, goals, to extend also to look into how the system itself functions. What is the functioning of the system, the mechanism, the process and outcome? How, for example, in a given economic system under certain philosophy or ideology, how does consumption, investment, and saving can be determined? What is the market structure? How to attain general equilibrium in the economy? So there is some difference there, you know, in terms of general universal principles versus a system based on ideology.
Now, how early did the Muslim scholars address the question of economics and the economic system? Is this something that has been around for some time, or is this a relatively new development in Islam?
No, it's not really new. In fact, it's interesting to notice that many economists tend to think that the first systematic way of treating or dealing with the economics as a subject goes back to the 18th century and connected with the name of Adam Smith. This was a Scottish economist who wrote a classic called The Wealth of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
But this notion that relates this study of economics to only the 18th century is quite incorrect, I should say. There have been so many Muslim scholars who wrote about economics in a systematic way from an Islamic point of view, and their writing goes back as far away as the 8th century.
Yes.
In the Christian era. That's more than 1,000 years before Adam Smith. I just have three examples of this here with me, but there are others also. For example, this book here is called Al-Kharaj, which deal mainly with what you might call today macroeconomic system. And that was written by a man by the name of Abu Yusuf in the 8th century. In fact, in the 10th century, a book with the same title was written by another person also called Yahya bin Adam. So that's another reference. In addition, there is also in the 11th century, a famous writer by the name of Al-Mawardi wrote the book called Al-Ahkam al-Sultaniyah, which again deals with the basic macro aspects of economics. And that was, again, in the 11th century. In the same century, also, another jurist by the name of Al-Farra wrote a similar treatise also. In the 11th century, also, we find a great writer by the name of Al-Ghazali, who also addressed some aspect of that. In the 12th century, a very famous Muslim philosopher, writer, scholar, by the name of Ibn Rushd, who is known in the West more as Averroes, a very famous philosopher, scholar, he also addressed the subject. In the 13th century, a scholar by the name of Izzuddin Ibn Abd Salam also addressed the subject. In the 14th century, a good treatment of the subject also was suggested by a famous Muslim jurist by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. In the 15th century, there were several contributions, one of which by a man by the name of Al-Maqrizi, and the other by Ibn Khaldun. This is again a recent reproduction of his work. Ibn Khaldun in particular was described once by the famous British historian Arnold Toynbee as the greatest sociologist who ever lived. And he was both a sociologist, economist, to some extent also, because he deals in some systematic way with some aspect pertaining to economics. From this few examples, like I said, it's more than 1,000 years before Adam Smith than the subject of economics in Islam has been addressed, at least economics in some systematic treatment. In addition to this, throughout Islamic history, there have been numerous jurists and scholars who also wrote about certain aspects of Islamic economics, or economics viewed from an Islamic point of view. Yeah. They addressed both, actually. But of course, this subject or this treatment was scattered in a variety of books of jurisprudence. But more recently, we find there are so many scholars in recent decades who started to address the subject, like Sayyid Qutb al-Mawdudi, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Muhammad al-Mubarak, al-Sibai, Abu Sa'ud, Isa Abdu, Muhammad Abu Zahra, Mundhir Tahf, Chapra, Omar Chapra, Muhammad Najatullah Siddiqui. There are numerous individuals who belong both to, you might say, the traditional jurist stream, as well as those who have had some study of economics in the modern sense, and they have been doing lots of contributions in trying to revive or re-establish an economic system of Islam, which I think would be very relevant to the Muslim as an individual in his or her own dealings, would be relevant to Muslim nations and societies, which in recent decades have been trying to imitate all kind of imported economic systems from East and West, but still were unable to solve their problems. So there's a kind of call back to the foundation of the heritage of Islamic economics, to establish the system on the basic guidance of Islam, and as such provide a possible alternative to the present system. However, the task is not necessarily an easy one.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that we've had this source material that's existed for such a long period of time, why is it that research in this area appears to be so difficult?
Well, there are a number of reasons for this difficulty. First of all, the way that previous scholars used to write is a little bit different from what we're used to today.
Yes.
For example, you can go now and find certain books that has the title Economics, or some aspect of economics, or one specialized area of economics. However, the way that Muslim jurists wrote did not make that strict separation, because they viewed Islam as a complete way of life, and most of the discussions of economics were also interspersed,
yes,
with other subjects that they were dealing with. So in order to pick the specific aspect dealing with economics, it required lots of digging in this heritage or this literature.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Another problem also is that most of these references, for example, the three examples I have here from very old works going back to the 8th century, are all in Arabic. And there are few attempts, really. There have been some attempts to translate some of those works. But, of course, not all work is available in other languages. But, of course, the reason behind that possibly has been that these writings or works were written at the time when the Arabic language was the language of civilization and culture, being the supreme and prominent thing in the world at this time. Just like when you say today English and French or German are the language of learning. So that was the case at this time. So that would be another difficulty, of course, the knowledge of the language, or at least working together and closely with someone who knows the language. But in addition to this, there is another difficulty also, that any researcher in Islamic economics today would have to make a clear distinction between the principles enunciated in the primary sources of Islam, in the Quran and prophetic tradition, and between the various interpretations or application that has taken place in different points in history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the principles are binding on all, in all times, broad principles. But the specific application of those principles are not necessarily binding on Muslims today. I'm not saying principle, just specific detailed application or institutions. For that matter, I think it would be an important thing to sift through literature to find out which applications are subject to adaptation, which application need to be reconsidered, but still without violating the basic rules of Islamic law. But despite of these difficulties, we find that Islamic economics has its own general or basic methodology and its own distinct ideological foundation. And given enough time and effort, reconstruction, it will not be too difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what is meant by the basic general methodology for the study of the economic system of Islam? Could you perhaps explain that?
Okay, I made some quick reference, but perhaps it wasn't too clear in the previous question. When I was mentioning that the Islamic economic system has its own principles and philosophy,
yes,
and as such, the only way really to get to grips with these principles and philosophies is to refer back to the what I call the primary sources of learning about Islam and its principles, and that's,
yes,
mainly the Quran, viewed by Muslims as the word of God, and the prophetic tradition, which help to explain and elaborate and give indication as to how to apply those principles. This means then that a contemporary scholar trying to study Islamic economics would have to learn how to consult these primary sources directly, and that requires certain methodology, because there is,
yes,
certain methodology also of how to interpret and apply and properly understand those principles. He had to learn also, and that's an important part of the methodology, what are the basic rules or way of arriving at, mm-hmm, a solution to new problems which may appear from time to time or place to place, and to make sure that the solution of contemporary economic problems does not contradict the text or the spirit of Sharia or Islamic law. So it's very important in this kind of study that it would be based on those principles, and to make sure that there is consistency in the application of these principles. But mind you, it should not be really that hard, for one reason, that aside from certain aspects of Islamic economics or relating to Islamic economics in the Quran, such as the law of inheritance and so on, the rest are basically broad rules, broad guidance, which are applicable in a variety of situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you mentioned in your earlier remarks that the economic system of Islam has its own distinct ideological basis. Could you outline that ideology for us?
Well, the cornerstone, to start with, if I were to summarize it perhaps in six basic principles, the first one, which is the cornerstone, is that whether you're dealing with the economic arena or any other aspect of life or any other system in Islam, be it social, economic, political, you name it, everything has to start first from the belief in Allah, or God, capital G, as the sole creator, Lord, and sovereign of the universe, which means it's not just a lip service belief, but also the preparedness to submit to his will, to accept his guidance, and to have complete and unqualified servitude to God. This is the cornerstone. It might sound remote, but it's not,
yes,
because everything falls in line. On the basis of this, a human being then, on the level of individual or on collective level, would be much better off, or cannot be better off, to be more accurate, unless God is taken as the source of belief, the source of values, of what sense of right and wrong, and to have this complete preparedness to obey him in whichever he ordained us to do, and to avoid things that he forbade us from doing. That's the first principle. A second basic principle is that Islam does not accept the definition of religion, quote unquote, as something which is confined or restricted to the spiritual aspect of human life or the moral ethical aspect, but as indicated early, it takes religion as a complete way of life, something that guides your life in the moral, social, ethical, economic, political, you name it. They're all within one basic confine. That confine is based on the guidance of God in all of these aspects. That's why we find that in the Quran, for example, in chapter 2, verse 208, there's a beautiful reference to that. It says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا ادْخُلُوا فِي السِّلْمِ كَافَّةً. O you who believe, enter into Islam. Enter into unqualified submission and acceptance, conscious submission to the will of God, kaffa, wholeheartedly. So it's not a question of saying, all right, I'll accept God's teaching in the matter of worship, I'll worship him as he ordained, or I'll accept his teaching with respect to some broad, general, ethical or moral arena, and then I say, right, but as far as my economic life or social life, I know better. No, that's not the case. Everything would have to be within that basic guidance to have consistency. A third principle is that God created the human being on earth as his trustee. So you and I and he and she, everybody else, we are created to fulfill certain job, to fulfill certain responsibility on this earth that God has entrusted us to establish a civilization which is based on the moral and ethical, spiritual values that he's provided us, but in the meantime it provides also for ample opportunity for material progress. So it combines moral, social, material progress all in a harmonious direction. I would not wish to go in detail in this particular issue because in the previous, one of the previous series, Moral Teaching in Islam, we spent quite a bit of time describing this concept of khilafah or trusteeship and what it means and what it entails by way of human responsibility. But for those who might be interested in researching evidence directly from the Quran on this concept, I'll just give a few references. In chapter 2, verse 30, in 6, 165, in 42, 62, in 57, 7, in all of these and other verses in the Quran, it is clearly laid down that we are not here on earth by way of punishment or any other reason. We are here because God wants us to do and fulfill certain noble duty in our life here on earth. The fourth principle is that God, in order to help the humankind to fulfill that responsibility of trusteeship or khilafah, he has made everything in this universe subservient to the human. There are so many moving verses in the Quran. I'll just refer to one for the time being in chapter 45, verse 12. It says that God created for you, made subservient to you, everything on earth and in heavens, which even does not restrict human energies from harnessing and utilizing everything in quote-unquote nature, which Allah has created, or God created in nature. And this is not by any means the only reference in the Quran. For example, in chapter 22, 65, in 31, 20, in 67, 15, these are all verses in the Quran that urges the humankind to harness the various resources that God has made available to them on this earth. It follows from this fourth principle that enjoyment of the good thing that God has created, innocent enjoyment within the boundaries that God has given, is not regarded as sin so long as it follows His path and does not deviate from His limits. Like, for example, in chapter 7 in the Quran, verses 31 through 33, it says, basically, if I were to just paraphrase it, say, who has forbid the good thing and the bounties that God has created for His servants? So this is something that God has given to us. There is no hang-up, provided that the person would not go into an extreme, making his sole concern getting the maximum enjoyment in this life. So it's not an objective in itself, but it's not condemned either. Mm-hmm. The fifth principle is the principle of accountability, that there is a life hereafter, that as God has given us this trusteeship and resources, He's going to hold us accountable in the Day of Judgment as to how did we behave during our earthly life, which includes, of course, economic behavior. How did you behave also in the pursuit of our needs and satisfaction of our needs? The sixth principle is that the difference in wealth or variation in wealth in itself does not give a person neither inferiority nor superiority, because God looks not into our property or our faces, He looks in our hearts. So the question of wealth should not be a source of social distinction or superiority.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how in your view can the principles that you've just espoused influence day-to-day economic activity?
Okay, let's take the first one. That God is the source of all values and the ultimate authority. It means that for Muslims, individuals and collectivities or nations, they should not imitate or emulate any other system which differs from their particular principle, such as, for example, usury or interest. Secondly, implication of Islam as a complete way of life means again that there is an organic connection between economic activities and social and political activities. We cannot separate them. We can say, all right, business is business. This is just economics. You have to look at it in the context of society and ethics as a whole. Thirdly, implication of the concept of trusteeship of human being on earth means that God is the sole owner of this universe, and we are only trustees, which means that there is a different concept of wealth and right of property altogether, that we do own certain things, but the ultimate owner is God Himself, and we have to behave in a way consistent with His will. The fourth principle, for example, dealing with the universe being subservient to us, means again that poverty is not a virtue in Islam, and that productivity, so long as it's within the boundaries that God has ordained, is something which is praiseworthy. The fifth principle, in terms of responsibility, it means that the control on economic behavior would not have to depend totally, on the government or police enforcement, but there is also an individual policeman within yourself, that is the conscious itself become part of it, and that makes it quite unique and different from any other secular economic system. And the sixth principle, for example, variations in wealth, means that it should not be tolerated in a truly Islamic society, not paying lip service. It should not be tolerated that some people, because of their wealth, would have more control on the affairs of the rest of the people, that there should be some degree of equality. And all of these principles have more specific application as we move on to deal with some specific concepts like right of property and work in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll leave it at that for today. I think this is going to prove to be, God willing, a very interesting series dealing with economics and Islam. We want to thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.